We've been talking about this for 36 years, going all the way back to the nomination of Sandra O'Connor. And after that 36-year period, we only have a single individual on the court who has expressly said he would overturn Roe. So I think it's a bit of a scare tactic and rank speculation more than anything else.
Leonard Leo, Executive Vice President of the Federalist Society on ABC over the weekend, talking about the Supreme Court pick President Trump will make this evening. The president has reportedly whittled his options down to four people, all younger than 55, meaning they're likely to be on the court for decades. And just like Trump's first Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, they all come from a list compiled by Leo's Federalist Society. Here to tell us more about that organization and its influence shaping the country's highest court is Amanda Hollis Brusky. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you wrote a book, Ideas with Consequences, The Federalist Society and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. When did this organization become such a force in the judicial life of this country?
So the Federalist Society starts off as a ragtag group of law students, conservative and libertarian 20-somethings in elite law schools in the 1980s. Their goal really was to bring conservative and libertarian ideas and legal scholars into the mainstream of their own law schools, which they said at that time was controlled by a sort of liberal orthodoxy. All their faculty were liberal, all the network connections were liberal, and all the institutions they looked to were liberal. And so they start off just by trying to create community for conservatives and libertarians. And once they do, they realize that there's an opportunity to construct a conservative and libertarian counter elite. And that counter elite would eventually grow to be more than 40,000 members. And those members would be nestled in institutions like the federal judiciary, state legislatures, federal legislatures, the legal academy. And the network has really, we saw its influence most strongly, I think, beginning in the George W. Bush administration, after its members had kind of grown up and the network had grown up. If you look at the DNA of the George W. Bush nominees to the federal bench, almost every single one of them had the Federal Society gene. You could track their connection to the Federal Society. So I think that's when the organization really started to mature and have influence.
And they had some really influential early patrons, right? Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia.
Antonin Scalia was a law professor at the University of Chicago when the organization started. And so he's one of the first faculty mentors of the organization. Interestingly, Ed Meese, who was the attorney general for Ronald Reagan, took an interest in the Federal Society, brought a lot of the young Federalists into the Reagan administration, into the Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department. And there they really got credentialed. They had the backing of Ronald Reagan, Ed Meese. People started taking them very seriously from the 1980s on.
And the governing philosophy is what?
The governing philosophy of the Federal Society is to bring conservative and libertarian principles into the law at every level. So principles about free markets, deregulation, shrinking the size of the federal government, those really core principles of the Republican Party translated into legal principles. And they do this through education, through programming, through networking, through socializing conservatives and libertarians, then plugging them into networks in the Republican administration, putting them into positions of power, and then encouraging them to draw on those principles as they engage in policymaking and judicial decision making.
And on the Supreme Court, Justice Samuel Alito came from their list, correct?
Absolutely.
This was George W. Bush's nominee, successful nominee to the court. And he has been a reliable conservative?
He has, as has Roberts, apart from the health care.
He was also from their list?
He was. Roberts and Alito both were part of that early generation of Federalists that were working in the Reagan Justice Department. And so they were really groomed by the organization from its early years on. So when they were selected by George W. Bush, it was known to the Federal Society that they would be reliable conservative votes.
Okay. And so then obviously with Neil Gorsuch, there's a third member and now possibly a fourth.
Actually, Clarence Thomas is on the court now, and he is deeply involved in the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society has said, and its members have told me in interviews, that Clarence Thomas is the closest thing to a pure Federalist Society model of judging. So if you look at Thomas's concurring opinions in a lot of these cases, he'll vote with the conservatives, but he'll write separately to say, you know, I would go back to 1937, undo the entire administrative state, and start over. And so that really is the Federalist Society goal, is to have five Clarence Thomases on the court so they can really fully implement their agenda.
Wow. Well, I mean, it almost seems like their agenda is to, as you say, kind of start, you know, burn it all down and start over, but to have as little government as possible. How then do they see the role of the Supreme Court, which has taken on a very powerful position in our government?
Early on in the 1980s, there was a lot of discourse about judicial restraint. Judges should be minimal in their roles. They shouldn't overturn precedent. They shouldn't strike down democratically enacted laws unless they absolutely have to. They should be respectful. They shouldn't move the law too far, too fast. And that discourse was a reaction against the Warren Court in the 60s and 70s that created a lot of new rights and was seen to be activist in the Federalist Society way of thinking. And that discourse has moved from judicial restraint to a form of judicial activism, or what they're calling now judicial engagement, that it's the role of the court to correct the mistakes of past courts and to be actively engaged in striking down laws if they are at odds with what they consider to be the original meaning of the Constitution. So this is the idea that the Constitution's meaning was sort of frozen in the 18th century, and that the job of the judge is to go back and figure out what that original meaning was and then to apply that to contemporary circumstances.
How does that dovetail with some of the strong religious beliefs that some of these members have? And I'm thinking in particular of Leonard Leo, whom I mentioned at the top of this segment. He is a staunch Catholic. I believe he goes to Mass every day. So how does this idea of originalism also correlate with their, you know, religious beliefs?
That's a great question. And one of the tensions within the Federalist Society has been between more libertarian, pro-business, deregulation conservatives and the religious conservatives, the moral conservatives. Now, they've managed to bring those two factions together, and they've done it by looking at the Declaration of Independence. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, it mentions God. It mentions the divine, a higher power. And so what these religious conservatives argue is that our country was founded with religious, deeply embedded religious Christian principles, and that the job of the originalist is to interpret the founding document, to interpret our charter and the Constitution with that in mind.
Tell us a little bit more about Leonard Leo. He is a colorful character.
He is. So Leo's not around for the first decade of the organization. He comes in the 1990s. He's brought in to organize the Federalist Society's lawyer chapter. So there were student chapters in the law schools. They founded lawyers chapters for those students when they graduated law school who still wanted to remain connected to the organization. But the lawyers chapters, by and large, weren't doing much. They weren't seeing a lot of bang for their buck. They weren't well organized. They weren't well networked. And they brought Leo in because he's a sort of Washington insider. And his specialty is in networking, in making these connections and making those connections productive. And so he comes in to run the lawyers chapter and assumes the vice president role. From then on in, the Federalist Society had a much more public profile. They were out there. They were involved in Republican administrations more openly than they had been previously.
So reports out today that the president has basically narrowed his search down to two men, Brett Kavanaugh and Thomas Hardiman. And these two have been vetted by the Federalist Society. Tell us more about them and how they would fit in this mold.
They are both George W. Bush appointees to the federal bench. They have a judicial record. That record is clearly conservative on many different dimensions. As Leo mentioned, neither of them have come out and explicitly said that they would overrule Roe versus Wade. But both nominees have sympathies to the social and moral conservatives and those blocks within the Federalist Society. The confirmation hearings are these days mostly political theater. Nominees are not going to say anything that's going to cost them votes of moderate Republicans or those Democrats in purple states. And so the fact that they're on that list and the fact that we know that abortion is such a big deal, not just within the Federalist Society, but within Trump's broader political base, his evangelical supporters, I would bet a significant amount of money that anyone who is nominated by Trump would either overrule Roe versus Wade or alternatively really narrow Planned Parenthood versus Casey and the undue burden standard to say, look, we don't have to gut Roe v. Wade. We can just use the undue burden standard, which says that states may not pose an undue burden on a woman's right to access an abortion, but they can interpret that very narrowly from here on in so that almost nothing becomes an undue burden and states can effectively regulate that right away without having to overturn Roe versus Wade. Mm.
Do the liberals have an equivalent to the Federalist Society? So when Barack Obama was president, did they have an organization to vet nominees?
You know, the Federalist Society has been so successful in what it's done over the past 30 years that after the 2000 election, the left kind of took notice of them and said, we need a Federalist Society for the left. And so some of the lawyers on Al Gore's team teamed up with some law faculty at Georgetown and other places, and they started the American Constitution Society. It's an exact replica of the institutional machinery of the Federalist Society. But the issue on the left is that on the left, there are a million ways to get credentialed. The left has had a monopoly on a lot of the most prominent institutions of the legal profession for a long time. But on the right, there's only one. The Federalist Society has totally captured that space. And so Obama did not go to the American Constitution Society for his judges because there were a number of different organizations he could look to, the American Bar Association, the ACLU, prominent public interest law firms on the left. And so the left has a problem of too many elite organizations. And so they're not able to capture just one and have a de facto monopoly on credentialing judges.
Amanda Hollis-Bresky is Associate Professor of Politics at Pomona College and author of the book Ideas with Consequences, The Federalist Society and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. Amanda, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a federal judge gave the Trump administration more time to reunite some families separated at the border. Our Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here to explain next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Now to the pressing issue of reuniting families separated at the border. There are about 3,000 kids scattered across the country, some in foster care, others in facilities, their parents being held in detention or already deported. Today, a federal judge here in California agreed to extend a deadline to reunite families with kids younger than five. That deadline was tomorrow. Justice Department lawyers said they would not be able to reunite all the families by then, just about 50 or so families. The judge now wants an update on the administration's progress by tomorrow. And here to talk about this is our regular Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, so the White House says it's having a tough time getting these families back together. What are the reasons?
So the reasons basically fall within three buckets. On the one hand, they're saying, well, some of these parents were actually deported and we can't get them back, or we don't know exactly where they're deported. The second bucket is they were released into the interior of the United States and we're not exactly sure where they are or how to get them back. And the third bucket is we need to do more vetting to make sure that the parent and the child can be reunited, meaning there might be some history of violence or criminal activity with respect to the parent. But the bottom line is that the judge who said you need to unify these kids who are under five with their parents by tomorrow, that is highly, highly unlikely to happen. And so we're talking about basically two groups of kids. There's the under five set, and then there's the 5 to 18. And those kids will be reunited on a longer timeline.
That's a July 26 deadline.
Exactly.
Well, what happens if the government again blows the deadline? Are there any repercussions?
Well, let's say I think it's highly likely that that will happen again because of what we're hearing from the Department of Justice, which is sounds like an administrative nightmare, that they really had not lined up systems to keep track of where parents were and where their kids were. And so it's July 9th. I think there's every indication that they will not be able in 15 days to reunite those parents and those children. And so what we're going to see, frankly, I think is a repeat of what we saw today. The Department of Justice going back and saying, we need more time. A judge saying, you have to tell me why. And then a judge fairly likely saying, okay, but do it. And we have all these kind of different words for judges to say, but some version of with all deliberate speed, like as fast as you can.
But they're not going to jail anyone. They're not going to, maybe they'll fine the government. I don't know.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is a huge question of what happens when you defy a court order, if you defy one. And so a court could say, we're going to hold you, Department of Justice lawyer, in contempt. You could, as a result of putting a lawyer in contempt, put them in jail. I don't think that's likely to happen. I mean, there's basically two ways that you can punish people. You can say, I want your money or I want your freedom by putting you in jail. And in both those cases, I don't think that it's going to be the motivation that it would be for instance, for a private party.
Right. So it's a different situation when it's the government.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Meanwhile, there's another judge here in California making a decision on whether or not families can be held in detention for longer than 20 days. What's happening with that?
Right. So this is the case in front of Judge Dolly G. And my sense is that she believes that that 20 days is a really important deadline. Again, that kids, whether they are alone or whether they're accompanied by parents, cannot be held in detention centers for, I think it's 21 days or more. And she's recently reviewed this. I don't think that she'll change her mind. And at that point, it throws it back to the Trump administration, where they either have to say, well, we tried to change the policy, but we were thwarted by a liberal judge in the Ninth Circuit. And so, sorry, you're not as safe as we wanted you to be. So I think that, you know, it throws it back into the political branch to try and determine what they're going to do.
Okay. Let's turn to another story now. And this has to do with gang injunctions, a favorite tool of many California police departments and prosecutors to fight gangs. State is now in many jurisdictions moving away from gang injunctions. First of all, what is a gang injunction?
It's a civil court order that says don't do these things. So it says to people who are suspected of gang activity, and if that sounds broad, it's because that is very broad indeed. And therefore, it gives people a lot of discretion. It says you maybe can't go in this area. You can't wear this type of clothes. You can't associate with certain people. You can't even have possession of, let's say, like graffiti cans. And so these were very popular. For instance, like 20 years ago, this was a favorite tool, as you said, of law enforcement. And the problem really has been in the application. And so it's been very difficult for people, particularly in LA, to plead their case and say, I really shouldn't be part of this gang injunction anymore.
And so it has been challenged by the ACLU and other organizations as unconstitutional.
Yeah. And the constitutionality that's called into question is really it in application. So I think gang injunctions, just as a facial matter, are permissible, but the devil is always in the detail. And so it's who is subject to the gang injunction? How do you make that determination? And then again, how do people plead that their case to get out of it? And now this is, of course, something that is in the news because we have a president who claims that crime is rising. All indications are, if you take a decades-long view, that that's not the case. And so the question with respect to gang injunctions is, well, crime is down, so does that mean we no longer need them? Or crime is down, and so they worked so well, we definitely still need them. So that's one of the policy debates that's happening separate from the legal debate.
Well, I guess there's no way to know right now. We'll have to wait and see.
Right. We'll have to wait and see. So there's no way to know because there's obviously a number of different factors that contribute to whether or not crime rises or falls. And so I think that what we know for sure is that this will be highly politicized. What we know is that law enforcement likes at least some form of gang injunctions because it, frankly, is a great tool for them. We use it most often in California, but certainly other states have used it. And we know that, frankly, that the application has created a number of serious due process problems for people, again, who are subject to it, who, and this is, you know, fairly serious if you're told you can't go in this area, you can't wear these clothes, you can't associate with these people, you can't have these types of things in your possession.
All because of where you live.
There's supposed to be more indicia of you should be under the gang injunction than this is your address.
Mm-hmm. And yet sometimes they are no more than that.
And yet it looks oftentimes like it's based on where you are from. Yes, okay. that is a fair assessment.
Translation. Okay. Thank you, Jessica.
You would
Levinson.
Be a great attorney. You would be great at depositions.
I need to be able to pronounce prima facie.
We're not live, are we? Right? Yeah, prima facie.
There we go. Something in Latin. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the United States went to bat for the infant formula industry at an international meeting on breastfeeding. Shocking allies. And Sorry to Bother You is a surreal comedy set in the near future in Oakland. Star Lakeith Stanfield is here to talk about why the script spoke to him. That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Pet milk, the first food of millions of babies who start out life the pet milk way. And that's important, as so many doctors know, when they confidently approve pet milk for babies. Good whole milk, concentrated to uniform double richness with pure crystalline vitamin D, the sunshine vitamin, needed for sound teeth and bones and good steady growth.
In the 1950s, most women heard ads like that one and fed their babies formula. Since then, though, the medical establishment has swung in favor of breastfeeding. So it came as a big surprise when the World Health Organization tried to pass a resolution in support of breastfeeding and the American delegation opposed it. Russia had to step in to get the resolution passed. Joining me now is Jennifer Grayson, author of the book Unlatched, The Evolution of Breastfeeding and the Making of a Controversy. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. So happy to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so the New York Times reported on this yesterday. Did that surprise you that the American delegation was coming out in favor of, or at least supporting, infant formula?
It didn't surprise me. It surprised certainly a lot of people, I think, in the general public, and I certainly got a slew of texts and emails from friends and family. But the reason why it didn't surprise me is because, you know, Trump, I think, has been very vocal, possibly, about supporting the infant formula companies. But our government policy has actually been supporting the infant formula companies for decades now. And I think that's been really under the radar until now. And so this has sort of really brought it out, you know, into the light.
Well, there certainly was, decades ago, the Nestle scandal in Central America, right? Pushing formula on mothers there.
All over the world, actually, in Africa, in Asia, any country that was becoming a more developed country. Yeah, I mean, they were called baby milk nurses, and formula company reps would actually go out disguised as nurses and go into hospitals and push formula onto babies, and it resulted in the death of really millions of babies worldwide. And these were places, you know, where there weren't clean water supplies. You know, a lot of times there weren't antibiotics, the kind of medicine that we have in the U.S. that makes infant formula feeding possible. Mm. So that's originally where this came from, you know, this resolution to protect breastfeeding, why an organization like the World Health Organization would want to get involved.
Right. So this was aimed at developing countries.
Initially, yes, at developing countries.
Right. Okay. So why would you need to pass this resolution in the first place?
Well, I think that, you know, without a resolution like this, what's happened is the world has continued to industrialize, and women are out in the workforce, and, you know, they're not with their babies very often in developing countries in the beginning of life. It's important to pass it so that governments protect breastfeeding. They protect things like paid maternity leave, and so that they enable in countries where, you know, babies would die unless they had access to a mother's milk. So it really is a way of making sure that there is support for women worldwide to breastfeed. And by the way, this is also important in industrialized countries in the U.S. too, because, mm-hmm. you know, breastfeeding rates here aren't even what they should be.
Okay, so the infant formula industry, is this a particularly powerful, politically connected industry? Is that what we were seeing at this meeting, the power of the political purse, if you will?
That's exactly what we're seeing. I mean, we were talking about some of the biggest corporations in the entire world, you know, upwards of $70 billion industry. The two biggest infant formula companies, Abbott and Mead Johnson, are based in the United States. And so the government has a, you know, the U.S. government is protecting those interests. And I mean, in fact, through the federal WIC program, we provide free formula to 53% of American infants through that program. I don't think most people know that the U.S. government is actually the formula company's biggest customer.
Wow. Well, so what happens now in American hospitals? It used to be that infant formula companies, you would give birth and they would give you a bunch of formula, basically to say, hey, here you go. Get started using the formula as quickly as possible. Does that still happen?
Yeah, well, it does. Actually, a lot of people don't know that most hospitals are still supplied infant formula from the formula company. So a lot of hospitals no longer do those formula marketing gift bags, you know, like a lot of the ones a lot of us remember mm-hmm. with like baby hats that had the formula logos and, you know, little toys with the formula logos. They don't do that, but they still do supply unlimited amounts of formula for free, which makes it, you know, it really creates almost an incentive to give mothers formula if they need it.
Right. I want to play a recent ad by Similac.
I accept that you photographed your baby inside a teacup.
I accept that you enrolled your daughter in high school before she left the womb.
I accept that you no longer notice that spit up. Yeah, that happens.
Welcome to a world where moms support moms. And Similac is here for you too, with nourishing formulas devoted to fussiness, gas, spit up, and other delicate issues.
I accept that you do things your way.
Thank you. Similac, welcome to the sisterhood of motherhood.
So what do you make of that ad? Because it seems to say, look, there's been a lot of shaming going on when it comes to breastfeeding, and some mothers just can't breastfeed, and they should be not feel guilty about that and not be shamed into thinking that they're lesser moms for using formula.
Yeah, well, that formula ad was certainly a lot different than the one you played earlier from the 1950s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, in the 50s, formula companies could really advertise very blatantly. They could Back then, people even believed that formula was better than breast milk. But now we live in a world where breast is best. And yet we live in a society where the conditions don't exist to make breastfeeding possible for many women. You know, we don't have paid maternity leave. Many doctors don't know about breastfeeding. And so the tactic the formula companies have taken is that they're going to support moms. I mean, they kind of want to be the warm fuzzies that, like, a lot of companies have kind of created this effect that they want to be the people that they want to be the ones that people listen to, mm-hmm. You know, because they can't come out and say, well, we created a product that's inferior to breastfeeding. So, you know, I hate to be blunt, but this is really a way of manipulating moms and making us focus on shaming rather than focusing on what we need to get women, breastfeeding, and to really change our society to support women so that they can truly breastfeed their babies.
But if they can't, should they feel guilty about it from a scientific point of view? Will their babies be worse off if they're fed formula?
Well, you know, that's a really tough question. I mean, of course, no mother should feel guilty if she wanted to breastfeed or tried to breastfeed and couldn't. I mean, like I said, it's very difficult for us in our modern day society for so many women to breastfeed, given the conditions. But I mean, we really do have to look at the facts. Like, we know that feeding babies infant formula in their breast milk is associated with increased incidence of gastrointestinal and respiratory infections, greater risk of obesity, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and a host of other things we're just now uncovering. And by the way, I was exclusively formula fed as a baby. So this is coming from someone who was formula fed, you know, and it's tough to talk. I think it's tough for people to talk about this issue without a lot of guilt, but I think we have to start looking at the reality.
All right. Jennifer Grayson, author of the book Unlatch, The Evolution of Breastfeeding and the Making of a Controversy. Jennifer, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, You may know him as Darius from Atlanta. Lakeith Stanfield is now starring in the movie Sorry to Bother You, where he plays Cash.
Things are changing as far as the visibility, and I've gotten the feeling similar to like Paperboy in Atlanta, just the feeling of how the world is changing around me. And Cassius is a similar journey.
Lakeith Stanfield next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The film Sorry to Bother You is an absurdist dark comedy. It's set in Oakland, and it's set in what they're calling an alternative present. And it's kind of a fantasy about what might happen if our Darwinian economy goes on unchecked. There are the winners and the losers, and the losers, lots of them, end up in a place called Worry Free, a company where all their needs are taken care of, but they have to work forever for free. The lead character in this movie is a black guy named Cash, who's down on his luck, and he gets a job as a telemarketer, and the cash starts flowing when he learns how to use a white voice.
As always, we'll be getting that out to you right away.
He's so good at using his white voice and getting sales that he's promoted.
We just got the call. They think you're A1 material. You're going upstairs, my compadre.
And then he becomes part of the elite class. His activist friends are protesting. Things get even weirder from there. Cash is played by actor Lakeith Stanfield. You may know him as Darius from the FX show Atlanta. He was also in the films Get Out and Straight Outta Compton and Crown Heights. Lakeith Stanfield joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks.
You have a long resume for just a short time. I mean, you're 26 years old.
Yeah, that was a very flattering intro. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, it's all true.
Yeah.
So tell us about how this film came to you.
This film came to me, I was at Sundance a couple years back, and I ran into this man who had a really big afro. And he had some interesting clothes on and some really big boots. And I was like, who is this guy? And why is he following me around? And it turned out to be Boots Riley. And he had a script in his back pocket. And he'd pull it out and be like, I got this thing. And I think it might be interesting to talk about. And so after a while of just procrastinating, as I sometimes do, I began to look into his script. And once I did, I saw this story, Sorry to Bother You. And the first time I read it, I had no idea what it was, and I thought it was quite crazy. And so I just was like, whatever, let's move on to the next project. And then I went back and revisited, and I was like, I have to do this. I have to be a part of this movie because I've never read anything like this before.
So what changed between the first time when you were like, nah, I got to do something else, to I have to do this?
I think sometimes when you initially read a script, you kind of just give a once-over and you kind of just pick up on a couple key things and you're like, nah. But I think when you go back, so this is why I always try to read them more than once. When you go back and read it a second or third time, you really start to hone in and focus on the details of what's going on and really track and follow the story in a different way, at least I do. And so the second time, I really kind of understood what he was doing. And I was like, oh, okay, this is crazy. Like, all right. I'm in.
Yeah.
Like, totally, yeah.
Was what attracted you the political message as one thing that really made you say, wow, this is interesting?
The journey of Cassius, coming from not having much and trying to earn his keep in the world and find himself in the world, and in the midst of that, an internal conflict with himself and who he had become, I thought was an interesting thing and something that I felt that to an extent I was going through at the same time. So I felt that could be interesting to explore. The ideas about how it applied socially on a larger scale were just like icing on the cake.
Mm. Well, talk about that, how you related to the character, because you grew up in Victorville, right?
Mm.
And so now you're a star, you're a celebrity, right? Do you get recognized now?
Yeah.
So that's quite a difference from where you grew up.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah, things are changing as far as the visibility and things are concerned. And just my whole lifestyle has kind of had to change. And everything has just been shifting this past couple years quite rapidly. So I've gotten the feeling of similar to like Paperboy in Atlanta, just the feeling of how the world is changing around me. And Cassius is a similar journey when he starts to become successful at the job as a telemarketer that he's working at. So I kind of had that, saw that parallel there, and I was like, this would be something that I want to explore within myself. And so I wanted to do that with Cassius.
Mm-hmm. So he literally has a white voice mm-hmm. in the movie.
Yeah.
And obviously that's a metaphor,
mm-hmm.
right? So I guess I'm wondering in your own life if you've had to put on a white voice.
I'm speaking English. No, I guess
metaphorically.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to some extent, I guess anyone that's ever had to, you know, hold a position or a job where they've had to assume some other type of role in order to do what they had to do is, and to some extent, assuming the quote-unquote white voice, because it's necessary for our survival. We've always had to act, and to an extent, that's just an act to bring about, you know, the results that you want, which is to move forward in your career, whatever it might be.
Yeah. So when you first came here, how did you envision your career? What were your goals as an actor when you first came here from Victorville?
To act.
in anything,
work.
Or did you have a goal in mind, like what you wanted to do?
No, I just wanted to work, and any opportunity I got, I just wanted to take a hold and hopefully from there begin to build something else. But my main preoccupation was just like, I just want to be on a set. So I'm auditioning and trying to secure anything I can do. And, you know, so yeah, I was very hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Quite like Cassius in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah. Right. So he, in the movie, he's desperate for a job because mm-hmm. he lives in his uncle's garage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really funny scene at the beginning where he's fooling around with his girlfriend. Somehow the garage door opens and there's everyone's walking down the street. Oh, there's Jesse into his life.
Thought you said you fixed that.
My landlord was supposed to fix it.
And he drives this really sad car. And so he's desperate for a job, but it also appears that he's desperate for meaning. Finding something that means something to him.
Mm-hmm.
Why does being a telemarketer fulfill that need for him?
I think it gives him a sense of purpose and belonging, and it also makes him feel like he's good at something. And I think for the majority of Cassius's life, he didn't know what he was good at and couldn't find what he was good at, and kind of felt aimless in the world. And I think this provided him with an opportunity to say, well, I attach my meaning to this thing I'm really good at, and it yields results as well. And now I can actually live better because I'm getting better at it. And I think that's what it gave him, a sense of purpose and sort of direction.
In the sense that his value also would be tied up with material success as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was driving a rinky-dink car, and mm-hmm. all of a sudden it became a really nice car, and he was in a garage, and it became a nicer garage.
A nicer garage. A much nicer garage.
Yeah, with many floors.
Like a penthouse.
Yeah.
So, and nice suits, and mm-hmm. then he gets invited to these parties, and then he has to decide whether or not he's going to cross a picket line that his friends are protesting in.
Mm-hmm.
And then he makes the decision to do that.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a common conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had that question as you've been choosing roles or deciding what to play, deciding what your career would be?
Definitely, because, you know, earlier I stated when I first came, I was attempting just to find work, and that's all it was. And as my career began to develop, then I saw that there was opportunity to try and tailor the work that I was doing in order to grow from it and learn from it and feel from it and become a fuller human being. It became an extension of my life after a while. And so I wanted the work that I was doing to reflect the different journeys and paths that I was taking in life, because it also worked hand in hand. Because if what I was doing mirrored what I was living, then it was better work. Like the work that I was doing that didn't mirror that was just like, I'm just kind of dancing in the balance. But I wanted to have meaning, like Cassius. And so I wanted to take these life lessons that I was learning and kind of weave them into my work. And so that meant that now I had to maybe sometimes not always take the money and sometimes take the things that meant more. Actually, Sorry to Bother You was one of those things. We made this on very little means, but it was something that I really, really believed in and that everyone that I was around believed in. And it turned out to be great.
Yeah. What about Atlanta when you got the role of Darius?
Yeah, young Darius. That was another one that was really challenging for me at first because I didn't understand it. I didn't get Darius, and I just thought he was kind of like this dopey, like uninspired character that didn't move me one way or the other until I came back and revisited about a third time. And then I was like, oh, okay, so there could be something here to explore.
Because I think he has developed. In the first season, he was just the comic relief, really.
Mm-hmm.
And now in the second season, he's become kind of a way more interesting character.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he was a comic relief in the first season, but there were still, I think, implications that could be made about certain things he would say. It was just a little tidbit thing just to make you think about, like, if I really take that and unpack that, what does that mean? And we explored more of that in the second season. But, yeah, he's just a really interesting character that has a lot of exploration that still needs to take place.
Have you ever had an encounter like you did with Teddy Perkins?
Yeah, the encounter that I had with Teddy Perkins was that exact thing, because I didn't know who that was. It was just I showed up and this strange man was here, and I was like, who the hell is this guy?
You didn't know it was Donald Glover?
No.
You're kidding, when you were filming?
Yeah, no, for the first couple scenes, I just didn't know who the hell this person was. And it was really kind of creepy. Like, I really don't know who this man is. Like, it's not like a...
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you found out, how did you find out, first of all?
I found out much later, a little birdie. I was asking everyone on set. I was like, who's this guy? Who's this guy? And someone said, bah. And I was like, oh. And my mind was blown. I was like, what? Like, I was looking in this guy's eyes. That's not... And I still don't quite believe it.
So when the director would yell cut and you guys stopped filming, he wouldn't be out of character? He wouldn't say, hey...
No. The only person I saw the entire time filming Teddy Perkins was Teddy Perkins.
And how long did that go on?
The duration of the whole filming of the episode. And then Teddy disappeared and I never saw him again.
So you're still not entirely convinced it was Donald Glover?
No, I'm not. I cannot be tricked in this way.
That kind of blows my mind. It makes me rethink that episode now. I need to go back and watch it.
Yeah. It definitely blew my mind. The time stopped for a little while. I was like, oh.
Was anyone else fooled or was everybody in on it except for
everyone
you?
Everyone was in on it except for
you're
me.
The only one.
Yeah. So they were just, they just cleverly thought out this thing and told everyone just like, play along.
Because you wanted to get your authentic reaction. Like,
that might have been why. I'm not sure. Maybe they just wanted to play a joke.
I'm going to say. So it seems that you do enjoy playing characters in surreal situations. And the character that you played in Get Out, there seems to be a similarity to the character you're playing in this movie where you have to channel your white voice with both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because the character in Get Out, he's a white guy trapped in a dead black man's body, like a ghost kind of thing.
Yeah, like a zombie.
Yeah. I mean, did you think about that when you were filming this movie, like the parallels?
No. It was kind of a completely different story. I think I don't know. This is not like the taking over of a body as much as it is assuming. So, like, the white voice represents not really, like, a white person's voice, but more like a perception and disposition or an idea.
You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
When people say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal, like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Just more of a comfortability and just feeling at ease and knowing it's going to be all right. And that's a position that's not always afforded to people who aren't white all the time in this country, and not all white people, but more generally speaking. So it's more just a positioning thing than a actual becoming white, I guess.
Yeah. And so the whole white voice is really about just knowing that you belong.
Exactly.
Like knowing, not questioning your presence.
Exactly.
Or the right to be there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
So I guess he's also saying that it's a swindle, right? I mean, the better you are at doing that, the better you can swindle other people.
Yeah. You can slide by undetected and no one's going to second guess. Because it's just the like, as you say, like the normal thing. It's just like that's the standard. So it makes, you know, it makes sense. Same thing with like standard English. Like if you're black in America, you know there's like two voices at least that you have. And there's one where you're kicking it with your homies and you're talking and it's like, it's cool. Like, what's up, bro? You know. And then there's the one where you're in the interview and you must talk a certain way in order to secure the job. And that's just a thing, that kind of an unspoken thing that we all kind of understand that it's necessary. And it's referred to in this movie as the white voice.
I mean, it's interesting that it's set in Oakland, which you're probably too young to remember this, but there was a huge furor over Ebonics in Oakland. And the fact that they were teaching Ebonics in the public schools and everyone got freaked out about it. And
teaching Ebonics, you mean it was part of the curriculum?
To
learn how to speak in Ebonics?
Well, to sort of celebrate it kind of thing. And then, you know, people who are about, America, we should speak in a certain way, were outraged.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I think it'd be quite nice to talk about Ebonics and explore that a little bit. Ain't nothing wrong with a little bit of Ebonics.
You have lots of voices.
I've been speaking to you in my radio voice the whole time.
Oh, you have?
I don't know if you've noticed this.
I have noticed. It's your public radio voice.
Yes.
On top of that. I guess we all have lots of different voices, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
That's Lakeith Stanfield, actor and star of the new film, Sorry to Bother You. All right, Christian Bordahl is here.
Hey, Madeline Brand.
In his feedback voice.
Welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
It's nice to hear. To have you back with us.
Well, it's nice to be here.
To hear your dulcet tones.
Especially in the air-conditioned studio.
Yes, exactly. Better than being outside.
Very nice.
Well, we talked earlier about this New York Times story, this resolution in support of breastfeeding at the World Health Organization in the spring. Ecuador was going to introduce it, expected to pass easily. And then America opposed.
Right.
And everyone was surprised.
Ecuador with some sanctions if they didn't.
Exactly.
Go
and then
along.
A bunch of other countries pulled out because they didn't want to get in America's crosshairs. Finally, Russia steps up and gets it passed, ironically. And of course, this was all about protecting the infant formula industry, huge industry worth something like $70 billion. So I asked our listeners about this issue because, you know, it's one that is a touchy one for many mothers, this question of formula versus breastfeeding,
right,
and how to deal with that. So Kendra St. Clank writes in, my mom gave us formula and cereal because she thought breastfeeding was gross. I wish we'd had a better education on the matter. Formula is great and necessary, but breastfeeding should be the ideal. Amber Van Dyne agrees, I think breast is best if you can do it. I couldn't, so I went with formula, and they're both healthy and happy kids. Nancy Foster asks, is someone in the administration a major stockholder in an infant formula manufacturer? It's a very personal choice to be made by a family with medical counsels from doctors and nurses. My firstborn was a weak eater at best. I tried formula, but he responded much better with pumped breast milk. Not fun for me, but worth it. So I also polled on this. 47% said they breastfeed only. 8% said formula only. 45% said they did a bit of both.
Hmm.
So there you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. It seems that controversy never goes away.
It will never go away, and it seems to just come and go over time, doesn't it?
It does. All right. Well, thank you, Christian Bordahl.
Sure.
I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.